tonight we're going to do Malachi. The book is interesting because Malachi in Hebrew simply means my messenger or my angel. So some places it gets translated as messenger, sometimes it gets translated as angel, depending on the context. Nobody is really sure who wrote it. Lots of people believe that there was a person named Malachi. But the thing about it is, if you look at the other prophets, certainly at least the major ones, all say who they are. In Isaiah, for example, it says the vision of Isaiah, the son of Amos. Well, in Malachi, there's no son of anything. It is just Malachi. From that perspective, it's unknown who this guy was. Speculation I have read is it may have been Ezra, may have been Nehemiah. The setting of the prophecy is after the Babylonian return. The best guess as to when it was written be somewhere in the range of 400 BC. So Nehemiah came from Babylon to finish the wall of the city, and that was in 444. We'll spend a little time in Nehemiah tonight because context is useful. This is after the Babylonian return. And what the book will talk about is laxness in worship by the priests. He upbraids the priests quite a bit. Also upbraids Judah. So he comes from Persia, builds a wall, goes back to Persia, and then comes back. One of the things about the second temple is there were some people there who had seen the first temple. And when they saw the second one, they wept because A, its grandeur was nowhere near equivalent to the one that had been destroyed, Solomon's temple. And furthermore, the Shekinah, the presence of God, never entered that temple. So Nehemiah, over and over, has got to grab the returning exiles and jack them up for, among other things, marrying foreign wives, not supporting the temple, not supporting the priesthood, letting things go to ruin, and so forth. All of these are things that are being talked about in Malachi. So the speculation is that it was written possibly by Ezra, possibly by Nehemiah, but certainly after the construction of the second temple. When the Babylonians captured Judah and took them into exile, it was for 70 years. And at the end of 70 years, Daniel recognized that the time was come and he went into prayer. And by that time, lots of people had put down roots in Babylon. So they had to sort of work to find a crew that would go back. They had to work especially hard to get a priesthood that would go back because everybody had sort of settled into Babylon. And so once they decided to come back, they were enthusiastic for the fulfillment of the promises of God for Israel. There's lots of promises in the major prophets especially that God would send them into exile, but he would bring them back, and then he would be their God, and they would be his people, and things would be glorious. Well, things aren't glorious. They are a minor province in a backwater of Persia. One of the things that happens as a result of this is their enthusiasm dries up, and they start neglecting worship. The priests sort of haphazardly slapdash the sacrifices. It's just blah. Nothing's going on. Well, in Nehemiah 13, when Nehemiah comes back the second time, he talks about a lot of the things that Malachi is going to talk about. On that day, they read the book of Moses in the hearing of the people, and it was found written that no Ammonite or Moabite should ever enter the assembly of God, for they did not meet the people of Israel with bread and water, but hired Balaam against them to curse them. Yet God turned the curse into a blessing. As soon as the people heard the law, they separated from Israel all those of foreign descent, which is to say there were a whole bunch of them there. Now, before this, Eliashib, the priest, who was appointed over the chambers of the house of our God, and who was related to Tobiah. You remember Tobiah was a major player in trying to stop the building of the wall and trying to stop the rebuilding of Jerusalem. So he has been an enemy of Nehemiah. Well, Eliashib is related to it. Now, before this, Eliashib the priest, who was appointed over the chambers of the house of our God and who was related to Tobiah, prepared for Tobiah a large chamber where they had previously put the grain offering and the frankincense, the vessels and the tithes of grain, wine, and oil, which were given by commandment to the Levites, singers, and gatekeepers, and the contributions for the priest. While this was taking place, I was not in Jerusalem. For in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, I went to the king, and after some time I asked leave of the king to come to Jerusalem, and I discovered the evil that Eliashib had done for Tobiah, preparing for him a chamber in the courts of the house of God. I was very angry, and I threw all the household furniture of Tobiah out of the chamber. Then I gave orders, and they cleaned the chambers, and I brought back there the vessels of the house of God with the grain offering and the frankincense. Eliashib has moved an enemy of Israel into the temple, and in that process, the storage stuff got shifted somewhere else, and quite frankly, they weren't bringing the stuff in anyway. So down to verse 10 of Nehemiah now. I also found out that the portions of the Levites had not been given to them, so that the Levites and the singers who did the work had fled each to his field. So I confronted the officials and said, "Why is the house of God forsaken?" And I gathered them together and got them in their stations. Then all Judah brought the tithe, the grain, the wine, and oil into the storehouse, and I appointed as treasurer over the storehouse Shelemiah, the son of Zadok, the scribe, and Pedaliah of the Levites, as their assistant, and as their assistant, Hanan, son of Zakur. So what he's done is he's discovered not only have we got rats in the temple, the people who are supposed to be operating the temple, the Levites, the singers, and priests, and all that, are not getting paid. So they have to go out and work their own fields, which means that they're not doing the things that God would have them do. So then he talks about Sabbath. And then finally he goes through the people again and gets rid of the foreign women who have been married into Judah. So all of the stuff we're going to read about in Malachi, you can see the background for that at the end of Nehemiah. Malachi is the last book in the Tanakh. After Malachi, from the Jews' perspective, things have been silent for 2,500 years. From a Christian perspective, they were silent for 400 years. And then we had the birth of Yeshua and the prophets and so forth. The rabbinic Jews don't recognize that as being from God. So Christians call it the 400 silent years from the Jewish perspective. The last word that they had was in 400 BC. So as he goes through this, he's going to jack up the priests and the Judeans for not doing what they're supposed to do. It's a series of questions. God will say something, and then there will be this rhetorical, "but you say," and then we'll get a sarcastic question. That's sort of the structure of the book. God is speaking through his messenger, whoever that happens to be, and is upbraiding Judah and the priests, and Judah and the priests are coming back with snark. They're not taking the word seriously. So that's where we are. The oracle of the word of the Lord to Israel by Malachi. "I have loved you," says the Lord. "But you say, how have you loved us?" The prophet says, God says that he loves them. And they come back with snark saying, "Yeah, right. How's he done that? What's he done for me lately?" kind of thing. "So I have loved you," says the Lord. "But you say, how have you loved us? Is not Esau Jacob's brother?" declares the Lord. "Yet I have loved Jacob, but Esau I have hated. I have laid waste his hill country and left his heritage to jackals of the desert. If Edom says, 'We are shattered, but we will rebuild the ruins,' the Lord of hosts says, 'They may build, but I will tear down, and they will be called the wicked country, and the people with whom the Lord is angry forever. Your own eyes shall see this, and you shall say, Great is the Lord beyond the border of Israel.'" Obviously, Edom was destroyed, and it was destroyed by Babylon. So after the Babylonian invasion, Edom was destroyed, and the remnants of Edom got pushed west by nomadic tribes, and they wound up settling in Judea. They became the Idumeans. Idumea was a region then in Judah after Edom got shoved out. And of course, you all know the most famous Idumean of them all was Herod the Great. He was a Edomite or an Idumean. As God is talking about this, he is saying, the way I have treated Israel versus the way I have treated Esau is very different. And that's because I loved Jacob and not Esau. And you can see that because Edom no longer exists. Verse 5, your own eyes shall see this, and you shall say, great is the Lord beyond the border of Israel. Because remember, the problem that is being dealt with now is they've got all the stories, starting back with Abraham. They came back to rebuild the place with these great expectations that now all of these promises of God are going to be fulfilled, and nothing. That's the reason for these snarky questions is, hey, you promised us, you haven't done anything. You say you love us, you're not even in the temple. This behavior goes all the way back to the Exodus. We read last time in the Torah portion that Israel's out in the wilderness, no food, no water, and they finally get manna from heaven and water from the rock, and they're trudging along, and they get really grumpy and say, is God even with us? Now, this is despite the fact that they have a pillar of fire and so forth. At that point, they get attacked by the Amalekites. So even in the wilderness, where everything that God has done is completely fresh in everybody's mind, you still get this, what have you done for me now? So that's what's going on in that first paragraph. So now we're down to verse 6. A son honors his father and a servant his master. If then I am a father, where is my honor? And if I am a master, where is my fear? Says the Lord of hosts to you, O priests, who despise my name. So now this is shifted from all the returnees to the priests. He is accusing them of despising his name, obviously inappropriately. But you say, how have we despised your name? Verse 7, by offering polluted food upon my altar. But you say, how have we polluted you? By saying that the Lord's table may be despised. When you offer blind animals in sacrifice, is that not evil? And when you offer those that are lame or sick, is that not evil? Present that to your governor. Will he accept you or show you favor? Says the Lord of hosts. Hearkening back to Nehemiah, what worship was being done in a lackadaisical fashion. In fact, one of the things that the rabbis say about Cain and Abel is Cain brought a fruit offering, but he didn't bring the best because he figured God's not going to eat it anyway. It's just going to rot there on the altar that I've built. So why not bring stuff that's going to rot anyway? And according to some rabbinic sources, that is why Cain was sneered at by God, where Abel was accepted. But the whole point here is, all right, it's just going to be slaughtered and cooked, and a blind leg of lamb tastes just as good as a leg of lamb from a sheep that's not blind. So why waste a good animal that we would like to have for breeding stock? Let's go ahead and use these other ones because, you know, the meat's going to be just the same anyway, and it's all going to smell the same, and God is not impressed. And furthermore, he then puts it to them in down-to-earth terms. He says, you know that if your governor asked you for an offering, you wouldn't try this. The only reason you're trying this with me is because you don't take me seriously. You don't think that these offerings make any difference to how I regard and treat you. Bearing in mind that they've come back and it's been silent. Yeah, okay, we built the temple, we built the wall. Now what? God isn't doing anything. So they start taking God casually because he's not in their face. Whereas if you take something like that to your governor, the governor is going to look down his nose at you and you're going to be in trouble. It's the tension between the immediate and the eternal. And it's hard to maintain a focus on the eternal when nothing seems to be happening eternally. Verse 9, and now entreat the favor of God that he may be gracious to us with such a gift from your hand. Will he show favor to any of you, says the Lord of hosts? The idea here is they are doing the form of worship with inferior goods and then turning around and praying to God for favor. And I suspect that the prayers for favor are pro forma, like a liturgy. Okay, when we sacrifice a sheep, this is what we say. And God's saying, it isn't doing any good because you're not serious and sincere about it. Verse 10, oh, that there were one among you who would shut the doors, that you might not kindle fire on my altar in vain. I have no pleasure in you, says the Lord of hosts, and I will not accept an offering from your hand. For from the rising of the sun to its setting, my name will be great among the nations, and every place incense will be offered to my name, and a pure offering, for my name will be great among the nations, says the Lord of hosts. What he's saying is, you guys are doing this because you're bureaucrats, and you gotta keep doing the bureaucratic stuff in order to get your portion of the sacrifice and all that kind of stuff. It'd be better if you just shut the doors, because not only am I not listening to you, but you're annoying me, which you really don't want to do, quite frankly. The other thing that's interesting here is if you are cynical, as these people have become, this response of God sounds like whining. I'm a great God and you aren't. What do you mean you're a great God? You're not doing anything. Nobody pays attention to you. You call yourself a great God, do something. And so you could read this, if you were cynical, as whining on God's part. God's throwing a little tantrum here. Verse 12, but you profane it when you say that the Lord's table is polluted and its fruit, that is its food, may be despised. Now, what is it? You profane it. What they are profaning is the name of God. You profane it, the name of God, when you offer polluted food on the altar. And I guess another way to look at this is the world at that time is polytheistic. So there's lots of gods out there. The idea then that Jehovah is the God over the Hebrews. Okay, cool. Everybody's got their God. Jehovah's yours. Fine. Boy, he must not be very powerful because look how you're treating him. So they are profaning God's name to everybody else when they don't do this correctly and seriously. When verse 12, when he says, but you profane it when you say the Lord's table is polluted and its fruit, that is its food, may be despised. But you say, what a weariness this is. And you snort at it, says the Lord of hosts. You bring what has been taken by violence or is lame or sick, and this you bring as your offering. Shall I accept it from your hand, says the Lord? Cursed be the cheat who has a male in his flock and vows it and yet sacrifices to the Lord what is blemished. For I am a great king, says the Lord of hosts, and my name will be feared among the nations. But you say, what a weariness this is. In other words, all right, another prophet coming to jack us up for not doing stuff right, yada, 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 yada. That's literally the attitude that he is speaking against. There isn't any enthusiasm or joy on their part as they do this, and certainly no reverence. And that's what they're being jacked up for. And then verse 14 again, cursed be the cheat who has a male in his flock and vows it. Now this is not the first fruits. This is different. Remember in Exodus it said that every male that opens the womb is dedicated to God. Those animals should just automatically be taken to the temple. A vow, on the other hand, is where somebody, for some reason, makes a vow to God and says, I will give you this lamb in thanks for whatever reason. What they are doing is they are vowing a good-looking animal. I will surmise that they're doing it in a crowd to look good. Look at that magnificent sheep I'm going to sacrifice. But when they show up, that isn't the sheep that shows up. And he calls that a cheat. Chapter 2. And now, O priest, this command is for you. If you will not listen, if you will not take it to heart to give honor to my name, says the Lord of hosts, then I will send the curse upon you, and I will curse your blessings. Indeed, I have already cursed them, because you do not lay it to heart. And that's again what we've been talking about all along. They may be going through the motions, but it's all routine, slapdash, and no enthusiasm whatsoever. Verse 3. Behold, I will rebuke your offspring and spread dung on your faces, the dung of your offerings, and you shall be taken away with it. At this point, God is kind of grumpy with them. Not only am I going to not bless your offspring, I'm going to curse them. And if you remember, there are various things to be done with the insides of sacrificial animals. Sometimes they're discarded, sometimes they're burned, whatever. And what God is saying here is, you know, I'm going to make use of the dung in those sacrificial animals, and you're going to see it again. 4. So shall you know that I have sent this command to you, that my covenant with Levi may stand, says the Lord of hosts. And to refresh your memory, when Moses was up on the mountain, the children of Israel made a golden calf. And Moses came down the mountain and was really upset. And Moses was a Levite, and he called the Levites to him. And then the Levites went through the camp and slaughtered all the idol worshipers. At that point, what God did is he made a trade. At the Exodus, before they actually leave, Moses gave the instruction that every firstborn was dedicated to God. After the incident with the golden calf, that changed. And what happened was Levi became the priests, and there was a swap made where the firstborn of Israel were traded for the Levites. So the firstborn of Israel were no longer the priests, Levites were, and they made a swap for it, and there was a numerical difference between the firstborn of everybody else and the Levites, and they made that up with silver. So the Levites have a covenant with God wherein they are priests. And of course, one hopes that all of the priests we're talking about here are in fact truly Levitical priests. Because by the time of Christ and the Maccabean rebellion, the priesthood was being sold. And they had priests that were not Levites by that time. Don't know what the situation is here. And you remember as we went through Ezra and Nehemiah, there were these genealogies where the people who were allowed to serve as priests had to be able to prove their descent from Levi. And there were some number of them who said they were priests but couldn't prove it, so they were not allowed to serve. So one assumes, given the timing of the book of Malachi, these are in fact Levitical priests as opposed to what's going to happen 400 years later where we have priests from other tribes. So verse 4 again. So shall you know that I have sent this command to you, that my covenant with Levi may stand, says the Lord of hosts. My covenant with him was one of life and peace, and I gave them to him. It was a covenant of fear, and he feared me. He stood in awe of my name. True instruction was in his mouth, and no wrong was found on his lips. He walked with me in peace and uprightness, and he turned many from iniquity. For the lips of a priest should guard knowledge, and people should seek instruction from his mouth. For he is the messenger of the Lord of hosts. But you have turned aside from the way. You have caused many to stumble by your instruction. You have corrupted the covenant of Levi, says the Lord of hosts. And so I make you despised and abased before all people, inasmuch as you do not keep my ways, but show partiality in your instruction. Several things going on there. The idea of a priest is that they were supposed to be teachers of the law. You should be able to go to them and resolve questions. They were also very often judges. The charge that the Levites had is to give instruction to the nation. Well, these folks are not doing that properly. They are rolling their own, and they're leading people astray by their answers to Torah questions. They are also showing partiality in that they are judging, I would imagine, according to a bribe, or they are giving instructions according to what the questioner wants to hear. One of the things that happens in churches all the time is somebody will come up and ask a question about how he should behave. And you look at them and you know the answer they want, but it isn't the scriptural answer. So if, for example, you are in a church and your salary depends on congregation, you are tempted to give the answer that they want as opposed to the scriptural answer. That, for example, is why we have gay marriages in church and a whole bunch of other stuff. Because instead of giving the scriptural answer, the pastors and priests have given an answer that the person asking the question wants to hear. And that's what's going on here with the priests in Malachi's time. Verse 10, have we not all one Father? Has not one God created us? Why then are we faithless to one another, profaning the covenant of our fathers? They are Levites. So the covenant of their fathers is the covenant with Levite that we're talking about. Judah has been faithless. An abomination has been committed in Israel and in Jerusalem. For Judah has profaned the sanctuary of the Lord, which he loves, and has married the daughter of a foreign god. May the Lord cut off from the tents of Jacob and any descendants of the man who does this, who brings an offering to the Lord of hosts. So married the daughter of a foreign god. I am assuming we're talking about something like the Midianites or what Solomon did, where he married women from all over the place, and in order to keep peace in the harem, he built worship places for the gods that came with them. So what he's saying is, if you have married the daughter of a foreign god, it does not precisely say married a woman who worships a foreign god. Married the daughter of a foreign god, that can be spiritual or physical. I am interpreting it physically here at the moment. But understand, it can just be, I like that God over there, as opposed to I have been seduced by the woman I married into worshiping that God. Either one of those will work. And if you have married the daughter of a foreign God and then turn around and bring an offering to the Lord of hosts, he will not be pleased. That's what's being said here. And the second thing you do, you cover the Lord's altar with tears, with weeping and groaning, because he no longer regards the offering or accepts it with favor from your hand. They recognize something's wrong. So they're praying harder and praying harder and praying harder, but they aren't fixing the problem. Verse 14, but you say, why does he not? Because the Lord was witness between you and the wife of your youth, to whom you have been faithless, though she was your companion and your wife by covenant. Did he not make them one with a portion of the Spirit in their union? And what was the one God seeking? Godly offspring. So guard yourselves in your spirit and let none of you be faithless to the wife of your youth. One of the things that's going on in that time and that place is intermarrying with the surrounding tribes. One of the things that the Bible is fine with is polygamy. Remember Deuteronomy 21, where you have the beautiful captive, where you go out and you wage war against a city, and there's a really good-looking babe there, and you decide you want her. Well, it was permitted then to bring her home, change her clothes, shave her head, let her sit and mourn her family for a month, and then after that, you could then take her for your wife. The rabbinic question is, well, wait a minute. What if you had a nice Jewish girl at home that you were also married to? Well, the Bible allows polygamy. So what I am assuming is going on here is when it's faithless to the wife of your youth, it's talking about your first wife, and you have either taken another pagan wife in addition to your first wife, or you have divorced her in order to pick up a pagan wife. What God is saying is, I'm not happy with that, because when the two of you came together, a portion of my spirit is in there with you. And the thing I desire from you is godly offspring. Now, the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world. So if you have pagan wives, you will find out pretty quickly that you're going to have pagan children and pagan grandchildren. And so that's what he's talking about. Verse 16. For the man who does not love his wife, but divorces her, says the Lord, the God of Israel covers his garment with violence, says the Lord of hosts. So guard yourselves in your spirit and do not be faithless. The idea is one man, one woman forever. Verse 17, you have wearied the Lord with your words, but you say, how have we wearied him? By saying, everyone who does evil is good in the sight of the Lord, and he delights in them. Or by saying, where is the God of justice? Two different things here. Remember, we talked earlier about priests giving instruction and altering the words of the Torah in order to fit the desires of the questioner. And here it says, you have descended to the point where people who do evil are called good. And we in our society are there. Because there's all sorts of stuff that God calls evil that we are now calling good. You can see what the problem is. The other thing it could be is, where is the God of justice? Where is God? Why is nothing being done about these problems? And the answer to that is because it is given to us to administer justice on the earth. And when God finally has to administer justice, it's pretty violent. We're supposed to be taking care of it ourselves as we go along, as opposed to letting it stack up, as is the case here. And then God finally sends in a horde of Assyrians or Babylonians or Romans to correct the problem.